Welcome aboard the Shipshape Podcast, your ultimate destination for marine wisdom and expertise. Our skilled crew, comprised of top boating journalists and experts, is committed to delivering informative and captivating content week after week. We're eager to connect with and learn from our fellow mariners, and we encourage you to share our podcast with your friends. Remember, word of mouth is our lifeblood. And if you enjoy an episode, please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. By doing so, you're helping us forge a robust community of mariners who can learn, collaborate, and exchange their experiences out on the water.
Today on the Shipshape Podcast, we are talking with Mark Gleason, an accomplished account executive at Parker Smith & Feek, a leading maritime insurance group. With extensive experience in the industry, Mark has built a reputation for delivering solutions amidst the complexities of the maritime sector. Today, we're set to explore his insights on the industry's challenges, changes, and future. Your two co-hosts today are Meryl Charette. I'm a live aboard on a Ta Shing to Toshiba 36 in Boston, Massachusetts, and T.
Hey guys, welcome to the show. This is Talha Bhatti, and I'm in Virginia, living aboard my powerboat, and we have Mark with us, and we're going to be learning from his extensive experience. I understand it's 20, 30 years, so welcome to the show, Mark.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really, really happy to be here today.
So, Mark, where are you recording this from?
Today, I'm on the 29th floor of an office building overlooking the Honolulu Harbor in Hawaii, but typically I live in Seattle, Washington.
Nice. What's the weather like in Hawaii?
Right now, the sun has not quite come up. It's probably 75, light breeze. So perfect.
I never thought the sun actually went down in Hawaii. I don't have much knowledge about the boating industry out there. What's that scene like?
You know, obviously it's an island archipelago. And so, you know, boating is indispensable. But right now, I mean, I'm looking down over the harbor. I can see container ships, tug and barge. There's a large Coast Guard presence here. I can see several shipyards, there are commercial fishing vessels, there are passenger vessels, boat repair, kind of contractors that work in the shipyards. I can see the Pearl Harbor Naval Base in the distance. So it's a very, very dynamic maritime environment.
So Mark, you've been doing this for donkey's years. So where did it all start? Did you grow up on boats?
No, I didn't. I actually grew up just outside of Washington, D.C. My family didn't have any connection to the maritime industry. After I got out of high school, I moved out to the West Coast. And, you know, like a lot of 20-something-year-olds, I was in search of adventure. And I really wanted to go to Alaska. I had a good friend who had grown up in a fishing family and essentially said, well, if you want to go to Alaska, you should come down to Fisherman's Terminal on so-and-so a day and, you know, meet my boat down there, and we can drop you off in Alaska if you want. Maybe you could find a job on a fishing boat and, you know, you could work for the summer. So I did. I hitchhiked to Seattle. Went and found the boat at Fisherman's Terminal and just started walking the docks, introducing myself to different captains, found a job on a boat, thought it was just going to be, you know, a 2 or 3 month adventure in Alaska. And that was not quite 30 years ago.
So why Alaska though? What was the lure for that?
Well, I mean, you know, Alaska is legendary for drawing adventurers and people, you know, seeking thrills. And for somebody that grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, that, you know, the notion of Alaska, it was just so different than anything that I ever experienced. And I really wanted to see it. And I was fortunate enough to find a position on a salmon boat headed north. So, you know, I took the opportunity and have run with it since.
Was it like that TV show Wicked Tuna?
Not quite Wicked Tuna, although I do have an interesting tie-in to The Deadliest Catch. We can talk about that in a bit. But no, it was, you know, I can't even really explain it. I mean, for me, you know, I met the boat in Seattle. We took the boat down to Tacoma for a few weeks worth of gear work. And then we started to head north, you know, and by the time I got to the San Juan Islands in northern Puget Sound, I mean, I was spellbound. And from that point on, as you go up through the Inside Passage, you know, you're in these very narrow fjord-like, you know, bodies of water. Mountains come up from the sea right there. You've got, you know, fog-shrouded trees. I mean, it's stunning. I think the first 2 or 3 days, even when I wasn't on wheel watch, you know, we had this kind of net up in the rigging. And so I would take my sleeping bag up there and I would sleep up there just because I didn't want to miss a thing. It was just amazing. And then, you know, it was a summer full of hard work. It's very glamorous to talk about it now, but there was a lot of work involved. A lot of jellyfish, a lot of hard work, very little sleep, but it was wonderful. I mean, I was 21 and I couldn't ask for more.
So tell us a little bit more about that, because it looks like you jumped in the deep end. You know, what was like an average day on a salmon fishing boat?
You know, at the time we were, that boat, we were working in Southeast Alaska. So we were Ketchikan, Juneau, kind of that area. And typically we would have a 2-day fishing period. So we'd have 2 days on and then we'd have 1 day off. So on our off day, you know, we'd go find a cove and anchor up somewhere. And then usually, you know, when the fishing period would start, we'd wake up 2-3 in the morning, pull the anchor, make breakfast. What we were doing, we had to have visual, you know, we had to be able to see the fish to set our net. And so we'd wait for the sun to come up and then we would make, it was a purse seine, so it was an encircling net. So we would see fish, we would set the net around them. You know, we would close the net, we would haul the net aboard, bring the fish aboard. And as we were, you know, hauling in the net, I mean, the captain was looking for our next set. And so it was pretty much rapid fire. That boat, I think, could hold a little bit more than 100,000 pounds of fish. So as soon as we would load up, we would go, you know, it was impractical for these catcher vessels to go directly to the cannery to sell the fish. So they would employ larger vessels they call tenders. So we would go deliver our fish to a tender. Those tenders would aggregate the catch of several vessels and then deliver them to the cannery. So we'd deliver to the tender and then go back out. If there was still time, we'd go fish. If not, we'd go anchor up and wait for the next period to open.
Wow. That's a cool way to get into it.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. You know, the boat that I was fishing on was probably built in the, I would say, early 30s, you know, early to mid 30s. It was an old wood purse seiner built in Washington State. So not only did I get to fish, but I learned a lot about how do you maintain, you know, at the time of, you know, 40, 50 year old wooden boat, and not a boat that's just sitting in the harbor, but a boat that's working day in and day out, you know, subject to wind and waves. How do you keep that operating? I mean, it was an education. You know, I had been in college for a year or so prior to that. And I would say that my first couple of years out fishing was more of an education than I could have bargained for.
How long did you do this?
Well, at the time, I was fishing in Alaska in the summer. And then we would come back to Puget Sound in Washington State. And we would fish for salmon for a few months in the winter. And then I was crab fishing in California for Dungeness crab. And I fished year-round for a few years. And then I had a really bad season in Alaska. I came back actually owing my captain money, and I thought maybe at that point that it would be a good idea to go back to school. So I went back to school. I was living down in Central California at the time, so I went to California State University, Monterey Bay. You know, within Monterey Bay, I mean, that's John Steinbeck's Cannery Row, so there's a great fishing industry there built around squid and sardines. There's a great salmon fishery there. There's Dungeness crab a little bit to the north. So I went back to school. I continued to fish while I was there. During that time, I also started to work on research vessels. I worked for a few different marine labs in the Monterey Bay area. And that's also a hotbed of marine science research. You've got the National Marine Fisheries Service has a lab there. Got the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. I mean, it's a hotbed of maritime activity, hotbed of marine research. And, you know, it's also just a wonderful place to live.
So basically you go, you get your feet wet, you become this hardcore fisherman. Then you've had such a time doing this that you're like, okay, you know what? I'm going to go to college and study marine. What was your thinking with deciding to continue to pursue a marine related career?
So my undergraduate education, you know, the major was called Earth Systems Science and Policy. And so really the idea behind that is that you know, you're focused on largely marine resource management. So you have a firm understanding of the science that underlies that management, but you also understand how the science is used in the policymaking process. And so for me, the big thing was, you know, I was kind of immersed in two worlds. I was fishing, but then I was also involved in the marine science end of things. And what we were seeing as fishermen on the fishing grounds and what was being kind of used in the management context and in the research context, sometimes there was a disconnect. And so as an undergraduate, a big focus of mine was, you know, how do we take what the fishermen see on the grounds and, you know, on the ocean every day, and how do we translate that into the policy context and bring that into the management world? And so, you know, my major at Cal State Monterey Bay, I mean, allowed me a lot of flexibility to do that. So I did a lot of work around cooperative research or, you know, integrating fishermen's knowledge into the management context. And it was just, you know, like I said, I had a wonderful advisor I had excellent professors there. And then because you had that broader marine science community that I think had a strong appreciation for what the fishermen were seeing, but that wasn't their world. So they didn't really know how to connect there. And I was lucky in that they really fostered, you know, my development and my growth as being that conduit between the fishermen and management. But, you know, one of the things that I realized fairly early on, when I was deep in the marine science world, and that's very math heavy, and I'm not particularly good at math. So I realized my limitations as a scientist fairly early on. But what really became interesting to me was more on the policy side. So how are resource management decisions made? And how do you ensure that you have a continuous supply of fish that don't degrade the habitat, that allows for the production of more fish? How do you kind of manage from a conservation standpoint, but also make sure that fishing dependent communities and commercial fishing families are able to still make a livelihood? For a young man in my 20s, I mean, it was a transformative time. It was just full of opportunity. And, you know, when I finished with my undergraduate degree, I realized that I wanted to continue on with my education and kind of keep in that same vein. So I moved back up to Seattle. And I went to the University of Washington School of Marine Affairs, or what was then the School of Marine Affairs, housed within the School of Fisheries. So the University of Washington School of Fisheries, I mean, it's a world-renowned educational institute. I mean, some of the greatest marine scientists and fishery scientists that have ever been produced have come out of that program. And Seattle is just a hotbed of commercial fishing activity and just marine maritime activity in general. So great transition from my undergraduate to my graduate education. And then once I got to the School of Marine Affairs, same thing. It was, how do you take the science and put it into the management context? I continued to fish, continued to work in different facets of the maritime industry in Seattle.
You bringing up kind of this disconnect between the people that are fishing and then, you know, the policies, because obviously that still is going on in some regard. But can you tell me how you see like this way of collaborating? You know, what is the best way of, you know, connecting these groups together?
And what was a disconnect?
Well, I mean, the disconnect was communication. Let's say for stock assessment scientists, I mean, you have these stock assessments where you're going out and you're essentially sampling the same area with the same type of gear year in and year out. And, you know, you want to have a long-term data set that you can analyze and really look for trends and things like that. And so, you know, you need repeatability. Whereas with the fishermen, I mean, if you're fishing in one area and there's no fish, you move somewhere else, you go find the fish. And so oftentimes the researchers and the managers weren't speaking the same language as the fishermen, and they didn't get one another's perspective. And so because I was fluent in both languages and was able to help make those connections, you know, getting people to talk, if you can open that dialogue. And I think a lot of the times it was a very contentious relationship, and I think it was because people didn't understand what each other, you know, each other's perspective. But when you actually get fishermen and researchers or fishermen in the conservation community, and you get them to sit down and really, you know, what are your underlying motivations? What are the things that keep you up at night? What are the things that, you know, you're energized in the morning to wake up? When you get them sitting down and talking and open that dialogue, you find there's a lot of compatibility between those groups. And so, but the first thing is they have to talk, and they have to go into it with the idea that, you know, I want to understand your perspective and I want you to understand mine. And, you know, let's kind of check our guns at the door and come in here and figure out how we can collaborate and problem solve and get us, you know, get both of our objectives met. So yeah, the lack of communication was the roadblock, and opening up the lines of communication was the solution.
And has it improved since then? Like, is there now every fishing vessel has a researcher on board? Like, what does it look like?
I mean, I certainly think that things have been improved quite a bit. Obviously, we're never going to reach perfect. There's a lot of room for improvement. I would say that the management and scientific community is far more interested in what the fishermen have to say now and, you know, opportunities for collaboration than they had been maybe 30 years ago. And I think a lot of the fishermen as well are more interested. I mean, they, you know, they have the talk about a vested interest in the outcomes of management. I mean, there's not a fisherman in the world that wants to catch the last fish. And a lot of these commercial fishing, for a lot of people, it's not just a job. I mean, it's a culture. It's a way of life. It's oftentimes passed down through the generations. And, you know, for these, you know, multi-generational family fishing operations, I mean, nobody wants to be the last generation. Everyone wants to be able to pass that down to their kids. And so I think we've made a lot of progress in terms of having that collaborative work. I have friends in Seattle who, in the research community, who have done a lot of work on gear design and gear modification. And, you know, nobody knows a fishing net better than a fisherman. So how do you best modify these nets? For instance, bycatch. So, you know, bycatch is when you catch fish that you're not, that you hadn't intended to catch. So how do you modify the nets to minimize bycatch? So you still retain your target species, but you're able to exclude your non-target species. The fishermen and the scientists in Seattle have worked quite a bit on that. Yeah, it's definitely better, but there's always going to be room for improvement. And I think one of the other developments that I've seen in the past 30 years is that, you know, you have people coming into the university system. They know that that collaborative research with fishermen, that that's a viable option for them. That's a niche within, you know, the marine science community that they can fill. And I would say, you know, 30, 40 years ago, that wasn't the case. I mean, there were a few pioneering scientists, but in general, that wasn't really an option for most young students. And today it is.
Ahoy, investors. Are you on the lookout for a unique opportunity to invest in a thriving industry? Set your sights on ShipShape, the innovative platform connecting boat and yacht owners with top-notch marine service providers. Our team is committed to revolutionizing the marine repair and refit market in North America. But we can't sail these seas alone. With your support, we can enhance our platform and create a significant impact in the industry. Don't let this exciting investment opportunity drift away. Contact us today to learn more about joining our voyage. Reach out to us at info@shipshape.pro.
Well, if we kind of twist this and not necessarily talk about the fishing side of the industry and we talk about the research side, you know, it seems that the research side is kind of in their own situation. We've talked with NOAA in the past and, you know, they were like, oh, well, you know, we would love to get some super yachts to work with us. And clearly the researchers also want to work with some fishing vessels. So can you talk about the current state of kind of research within the marine industry?
You know, one of the things that I think is, you know, particularly with in terms of like physical oceanography and, you know, principles of currents and tides and temperature, salinity, all of the things that are kind of driving seawater chemistry change. You have vessels, whether it be, you know, super yachts or commercial fishing vessels, tug and barge. I mean, these boats are on the water day in and day out. And so if you're able to equip them with, you know, different types of monitoring equipment, I mean, they're a platform of opportunity. They're on the water every day. And so, you know, for NOAA, for example, you know, ship time is expensive. I mean, later on in my career, I was working in Washington, D.C., and I had kind of an oversight role over NOAA. And so, you know, we spent a lot of time looking at the budget and spent a lot of time, you know, thinking about research priorities and how do those fit in with the budget. And so ship time is expensive, but if you're able to use these platforms of opportunity that are out there all the time, you can get really great data that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get if you were relying just on federal research vessels.
Interesting. And has that state improved? Like, have more super yachts and fishing vessels now, do they have research equipment on board?
I mean, I can't speak necessarily to the super yacht side, but certainly there are more and more commercial vessels being used as these platforms of opportunity. And a lot of fishing vessels have federal observers on board. And so a lot of times they're mandated, but 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the idea of having observers on board a fishing vessel was relatively new. And so now it's, you know, I think a lot of fishermen are kind of begrudgingly take observers because it's part of the cost of doing business. But yes, you have a much, much more robust presence with researchers on vessels than in years past.
Nice. And so before we move on to the next part of your story, maybe just like some advice for some of our listeners and if they wanted to get into fishing or into research, like what's a viable route for that?
You know, the first captain that ever hired me, I mean, he didn't know me from anyone. I was just some kid walking the docks in Seattle. And the value proposition that I gave to him is I said, listen, up front, I don't know anything about commercial fishing, but I can work really hard and I'll keep my mouth shut. I mean, I'm not going to tell you how to do your job. I'm here to learn. I'm here to work. And so I think that's the biggest thing is go into it with an open mind and a willingness to work and roll your sleeves up, particularly on the fishing side, do the dirty work. Don't go into it with any preconceived notions or thinking that you know more than you do. Just go in ready to work and ready to learn. And I think in life, that's just a great way to go about life in general, but certainly in the maritime world.
For sure. And so, like you said, you went in with no experience. You had no expectations. So give us maybe like a crazy fishing story.
So I think possibly the scariest moment in my life, you know, we would set our nets pretty quickly. I mean, when we would see fish, we would see salmon jumping. You know, you want to set the net quickly so you can get that school while it's there. And so we had a situation where, you know, we were setting the net very quickly. The captain was driving the boat. He was paying attention to that. Everyone was doing their job. My job was essentially to make sure that the net went out the way that it was supposed to. But I, pretty dynamic environment. I mean, there were waves and things, you know, there was wind. And so a lot of things were happening all at once. And, you know, you have to be pretty agile, pretty mobile. You know, you're walking around a pitching deck or you're running around a pitching deck. And so I made a bad step and I put my foot in a bite of line that was headed over. That line was running through, they were stainless steel rings. They were about the size of a dinner platter.
Yikes.
And so there were probably 20 or 30 of those kind of looped on an iron bar, and they were going over one at a time, one at a time, one at a time. So my foot got caught in that bite of line going through those rings. And there was no way. To this day, I'm not sure how it happened, but my foot got caught in the bite of line. I saw it. I kind of turned and did this, I don't know, semi-ballet move, and my foot came out about 2 feet before it would have gone through those iron rings. And had that happened, I mean, we wouldn't be having this conversation today. And nobody on the boat saw that. My heart was beating a million miles an hour. After the net was set, one of my colleagues, you know, one of the guys on the boat looked at me. He's like, is everything okay? I said, no, not really. He looked and he said, you look like a ghost right now. Well, I mean, I came within about 2 feet of being a ghost. So
I was partially expecting a peg leg at the end of this story.
No, you know what? I mean, that would have been a good outcome. Had I gone through those rings, just having a peg leg would have been a good outcome. That was very scary. You know, any romantic notions that I had about what I was doing were certainly put in check at that moment.
They say it's one of the most dangerous jobs that exists. It's being an offshore fisherman.
You know, it is, but that's getting a lot better as well. I mean, there's an organization in the United States, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and there's a woman that works there. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Lincoln, and she has done amazing work with the fishing industry in Washington and Alaska over the course of her career to make safety improvements, you know, not come in from a regulatory standpoint, but really working with the industry to figure out where are the areas where people get hurt and what can we do to minimize the chances of them getting hurt. And so commercial fishing is and always will be a very dangerous job, but I think it's far less dangerous than it was in the bad old years.
And you'd mentioned the deadliest catch. Is now an opportune moment?
Sure. So I, later on in my career, after I, you know, I stopped fishing, when I got out of graduate school, I moved to Washington, D.C., and I worked in the U.S. Senate. I had an opportunity to do a fellowship there. When I left the Senate, I came back to Seattle, went back to work in the fishing industry, but was doing government affairs and more kind of regulatory work. So I was the executive director of the trade association that represented 70% of the crab fishermen in the Bering Sea. So all of the deadliest catch boats. And so, you know, that was interesting in terms of, you know, the show, it's a reality show, right? And it portrays some things, I think, very accurately, but other things, you still have to have good TV. But I worked quite a bit with Captain Keith Colburn from The Wizard. And so I would take Captain Keith back to Washington, D.C. with me. And we would go meet with senators and congressmen and other policymakers. And so, you know, I was actually on the deadliest catch very, very briefly during the government shutdown in 2013. One of the things that came to light was that crab fishermen weren't able to get the permits that they needed to go fish. So I took Keith back to D.C. We had him testify in front of the Senate Commerce Committee. And so for the entire, you know, 3 or 4 days that we were back there, the deadliest catch cameraman followed us around. I did everything in my power to stay off camera, but there is a very, very quick cameo as we're going into the hearing room. You know, I turned to grab Keith and go in. And so I made a very quick cameo on the deadliest catch.
Wow. And so you got into policymaking to the point where you eventually end up in front of, you know, Congress and really helping these guys out. Like, what made you that passionate about this side of the aisle?
Well, like I say, when I finished graduate school, I had an amazing opportunity to do a fellowship in the United States Senate. So I worked in the Senate Commerce Committee, but more specifically, the Subcommittee for Oceans, Atmosphere, Fisheries, and Coast Guard. So essentially, you know, we had jurisdiction over NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We essentially handled everything ocean related that wasn't national defense or offshore energy production. And so I got an amazing opportunity to see how policymaking is done at kind of the national level. I was also able to be involved with some international things at that time. You know, I was part of the United States delegation to ICAT. You know, the International Convention for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas. So really looking at how do nations come together to manage fisheries on the high seas. But when I was finished with that fellowship, you know, I really wanted to put that work or that experience back to work for the fishing industry. And so when I was running the trade group, we had a couple issues that I thought were really important for our fishermen. I mean, we had an issue with illegal crab coming into the U.S. market. So I had an opportunity to really publicize that issue. I gave many, many congressional briefings. I testified in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about different fisheries, international fisheries treaties. And being a part of the fishing industry was such a rewarding and fulfilling thing for me as a young person. And it opened up, you know, career paths and opportunities for me that, I mean, I never could have imagined growing up in, like I say, in the Washington, D.C. area. And so, you know, it was an opportunity to give back. But also, you know, I genuinely believe the folks that I represented, I mean, we were providing a great product to the marketplace. We were doing it in a way that really didn't degrade the ability to continue producing fish into the future. So I just wanted to put that experience to work for the industry.
And how old were you at this point going up to talk?
At that point, I was probably 36, 37.
Well, I guess there's still hope for me.
Well, I mean, I'm a reformed lobbyist these days. I mean, I'm not in that world anymore. Not really. But yeah, my 20s, I would say, were transformative in terms of being on the ocean and being immersed in the fishing industry and being immersed in the science. And then in my 30s, you know, it was kind of a process of maturing a bit and, you know, kind of seeing the bigger picture, seeing how can I impact that world? What can I do to you know, to leave a positive, you know, to kind of put a positive spin on things. And I think, you know, I mentioned the world of illegal Russian crab. That was a big, big problem. I mean, it was a big issue for U.S. crab fishermen in terms of diluting their markets. But from a conservation standpoint, unregulated fishing in the Russian Far East was a big problem. And what was really great about that particular issue was that certainly the conservation community had a dog in the fight, so to speak. They're very worried about illegal fishing, rightly so. Policymakers also, you know, have a concern over illegal fishing. And then because of the, you know, the economic impacts to the U.S. crab industry, U.S. crab fishermen had a, you know, a vested interest in that as well. And so earlier we talked about communication and seeing where there are mutual interests. You know, that one in particular, I mean, when you've got commercial fishermen and members of the conservation community going in front of policymakers, singing from the same song sheet, I mean, that's very powerful. And, you know, there isn't a politician in the land that can ignore that. Typically, when you see conservation organizations and industry folks in D.C., you know, lobbying the halls of Congress, they're sometimes not on the same side. But when you can bring them in together, policymakers take note of that. And so that was an issue that we worked on for quite a few years. We made a lot of really good progress. I brought a lot of attention to the issue at the highest levels of government. The United States and Russia, they get together annually and talk about cross-border fisheries issues in the Bering Sea. So I was part of an advisory group that advised the U.S. delegation in that process. So I was able to go to Russia 4 times for different meetings. And I think even the Russians at first really didn't want to hear about the illegal fishing happening inside their waters. But I think once they realized the amount of taxes they were available that they weren't collecting, then they got really interested in the idea as well. But that was, I think, a very gratifying moment when I started hearing members of the Russian delegation spitting back my talking points. That was, it's like, okay, now you guys get it as well. And then now we can all work collaboratively to figure this issue out.
Yeah, that's some awesome stuff. And I'd be a fool not to bring this up. How has the whole thing with Ukraine and how Russia is not, you know, really doing a whole lot of business with the U.S. at this point, how does that affect fisheries?
Well, you know, your timing on that question is amazing. I just read an article the other day and it was talking about, you know, we have what they call country of origin labeling laws for our seafood, and there are certainly loopholes. I mean, so we have obviously severed most economic ties with Russia. You know, Russia is a huge, I mean, they're the Russian Far East and the, you know, the Barents Sea fisheries in Russia. I mean, they're huge volume. I mean, they produce a lot of fish for the U.S. market, a lot of crab for the U.S. market. And so with the situation in Ukraine, I mean, that seafood is not supposed to be coming into the U.S., but a lot of the pollock and the crab that's caught in Russia is, you know, they may do primary processing in Russia, but a lot of it is they do value-added processing in China. There are loopholes where you can find, you know, Russian-produced fish processed in China can find its way into the domestic market. And so, you know, Senator Dan Sullivan from Alaska has really been leading the charge on kind of closing that loophole. But, you know, you still see you know, Russian seafood products making their way into the U.S.
So after your days of policy, then you shift into what?
So after 5 years with, you know, representing crab fishermen, I really wanted to, I mean, I love the work and I loved what I was doing, but I had been exposed to an organization called the Washington Maritime Federation. And really the idea behind the Maritime Federation was that, you know, there wasn't one kind of overarching organization that represented maritime industry, you know, writ large in the state of Washington. So when I left the Crabbers, I went and ran the Washington Maritime Federation. So that was, like I say, that was a statewide umbrella organization. And we had all kinds of different members. I mean, we had tug and barge, we had ports and terminal operators, we had commercial fishing, seafood processing, shipyards, boatyards, recreational vessels. I mean, we used to joke around. It was everything from, you know, container ships to paddle boards. And so really that, my interest in kind of broadening my focus. I mean, I had spent many, many years very deeply focused on the fishing industry. With the Maritime Federation, I was able to broaden my focus and work on a lot more issues that were, you know, that were issues that were broadly applicable across the entire industry. And so did that for a bit. That was a grant-funded organization. And so essentially when the money ran out, you know, the organization, I mean, the organization continues to exist, but it was lost a lot of momentum, lost a lot of steam. But did that for a while, then was a consultant, did some work for the Washington State Legislature around pilotage, pulsory pilotage in Washington State, did some work for a couple of different conservation organizations in terms of, you know, coming back to that earlier theme, how do you engage the fishing industry in management decisions and in advocacy work. And then, but at that time I had two young children. And so as a consultant, the time that you are the busiest is when you need to be going out and doing the business development to find the next project. And I had, you know, I think a three-year-old and maybe a newborn at the time, and started to realize that, you know, the life of a consultant and a father of young children, I mean, the two were not really compatible. And so that is actually when I got into the insurance world. I had built an associate member program with the trade association when I was with the Crabbers. And when I quit that job, several different insurance brokers came to me and said, have you ever thought of the insurance industry? Or, you know, have you ever thought about insurance? And at the time, you know, as a consumer of insurance, sure, I think about it all the time. But as a career, no, I haven't. You know, and the message they said, well, you really should. You know, well, my counter to that is I don't really know anything about insurance. And I said, that doesn't matter. You can learn the insurance. You know, what you have, you know, the understanding of the industry, the connections within the industry, that ability to kind of look at the big picture and connect people and connect the dots. I mean, those are things that you spend 20, 30 years in the industry to develop. You come in on day one with those attributes and with those skills, you know, you can learn the insurance side. And, you know, I kicked that idea around for a bit. And then I got really interested in insurance kind of at an intellectual level and thinking about it as risk management. And so, you know, early in my career, when I was really focused on the science side, that was managing the risk that potentially, the stock of fish could collapse, or managing the risk that the habitat that produced the fish would be degraded. As I kind of moved on in my career and did more of the advocacy work and the trade association and lobbying work. Okay, well, now we're managing, you know, regulatory and political risk. And so when I started thinking about it from an overall risk management framework, say, well, this is, you know, in many respects, the same. On the insurance side, yes, I'm managing, you know, the financial risk, but it's still a risk management framework. And I've got that built in from, you know, the 20 years that I've been doing these other things. And so, you know, that was how I got into the insurance world.
And then some would say insurance companies run the entire show. What is that true in the boating world as well?
You know, insurance is one of those things, you know, if you're at a cocktail party and, you know, somebody asks you, hey, what do you do for a living? And you say insurance, oftentimes people are really nice about it and they'll turn tail and run. But, you know, insurance is, I would say, one of the underpinnings of finance. I mean, if you think about it, if you're a business owner, right, and you want to do something, you know, you want to start a company, you know, really insurance is a risk management tool. And so, you know, you as a company, you have the risk that something bad may happen. So, right, so let's say you run a shipyard. There's a risk that you're one of your employees may get hurt. Or if you have a fishing vessel, there's, you know, the risk that your boat might sink. Insurance is a way for you to kind of transfer some of that risk, obviously for a price. But, you know, so you're not bearing 100% of the risk. And so the insurance companies, the carriers, are willing to accept a portion of that risk in return for financial consideration. So that's the premium. But I would say that insurance is one of those things, it's an underappreciated industry, but, you know, the modern economy couldn't exist without it.
What type of insurance do you guys cover?
So my clients, I mean, obviously I have a lot of commercial fishing. I have a lot of passenger vessels. So think about, you know, whale watching or excursion vessels. I insure shipyards. I insure marine contractors. So people that build, say, bulkheads or do harbor work. You know, other colleagues of mine insure tug and barge operations. We also have, cargo. If you think about, I don't know what the percentage of global commerce that, you know, that seaborne global commerce, but it's an ungodly high percent. If you think about every container on every ship, I mean, there's insurance. Obviously, there's insurance on the vessel itself and, you know, insurance for the crew members. But every single container on the ship has insurance. Every single box within every single container is insured at some level. So at Parker Smith & Feek, we provide a broad range of insurance products for the maritime industry. There's really not a sector of the maritime world that we don't insure in one capacity or another.
I went to law school. Almost a good chunk of the cases actually are kind of marine related. And marine is kind of the definition of like negligence in the law world.
Absolutely.
Have you seen some crazy insurance claims? You don't need to give any details, but has there been any, whoa, this is crazy?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm not on the claims side, so I'm not as engaged in that world, but you know, I work quite a bit with our claims people. And oftentimes, you know, if a client has a claim or potentially a claim, I'm the first call they make. And so they call me, they tell me the situation, and I bring our claims team in and get them engaged. But yeah, I mean, I've seen vessels sinking under very questionable circumstances or people getting injured in interesting ways. Yeah, I mean, the marine claims, I'm actually helping to put together a panel later this year of speakers. And really, the idea behind this, it's going to be all claims, you know, it's going to be attorneys that have worked on claims, it's claims adjusters. And the whole idea is they're just going to tell war stories for an hour.
That's hilarious. I remember when my first boat, it was a 1969 all-glass, a pacemaker. Mm-hmm. And it's apparently one of the first fiberglass boats they'd made. And I'd never had a boat. And I went to get insurance for it. And they're like, you've never had a boat. How can we give you insurance? Mm-hmm. I'm like, what does that mean? How am I supposed to get a boat then? Yeah, and then luckily, the last owner, he referred me to his guy. But why is it so difficult, especially, for example, like wooden boats, right? And I know they're making a big comeback, even in commercial terms. We've talked to a couple of people who've got these giant sailboats that they want to, you know, take cargo on or cruise people around on. Why is it so difficult for them?
I mean, look, a well-made wooden boat. I mean, the first boat that I ever fished on, like I said, was decades old. I fished on another boat that was built in 1919. I mean, wood boats, if they're properly maintained, they're going to last forever. But, you know, a lot of them are not properly maintained. But I think a lot of people in the underwriting community, I mean, they understand steel, they understand aluminum, they understand fiberglass. They don't understand wood as much. And really what they're doing from an underwriting perspective, they're managing their own risk. And so anytime you have uncertainty, that increases your risk. The material itself is probably less understood or less predictable than steel. But, you know, it's interesting. Something that came about a few years ago, just, you know, when early on in my insurance career, it was a young couple. They wanted to get into the fishing industry. They were buying a boat. But, you know, to your point, when they came to me and that, you know, we need to get insurance. And so, I mean, they're young. Even though the husband came from a multi-generational fishing family, had grown up on boats his entire life. The wife had fished for many years, had also worked on sailboats. And I mean, they were very experienced on the water. But for them to get insurance with no track record, I mean, the cost was prohibitive. And so that ended up being the thing that kept them out. The permits, the boats, I mean, they could figure out the financing for the vessel. They could get the permits they needed. But it ultimately ended up being, you know, the cost of insurance that it prohibited them from getting a start in the industry. And that, I mean, that was heartbreaking for me. But, you know, wood boats they're a tough class of business to insure. Wood fishing vessels are very, very hard. And we have in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, we have a lot of wood fishing vessels that have been, you know, fishing for 50, 60, 70 years, have a great track record. But the appetite for risk that the underwriting community has doesn't necessarily include wood.
Well, let me ask you, you know, when we start talking about marine insurance and obviously your background, right? You're coming from the marine industry, so you know what's up. And the reality of what I've seen is that not necessarily everyone that's working within marine insurance actually knows anything about boats or that type of stuff. And also, I recently heard from this person who was doing insurance that boats that are over 40 years old are all of a sudden all just going to lose their insurance. And I was telling a friend of mine about that, and their boat was like 38 years old. And they started just constantly thinking about it and talking about it. And then one day they get a message, "Up, your insurance is gone," because of Geico pretty much saying that you can't use a third party type of vendor and you can only go through Geico. So can you talk about kind of the present state of insurance in boating and what that looks like and the issues and challenges that are faced?
Well, I mean, you made reference to Geico. And so my assumption is that you're talking about a recreational boater. Yes. And so that is not my area of expertise. You know, I'm much more on the commercial side of insurance. So I don't want to speak outside of school and talk about the recreational market as much. But in general, I mean, obviously you've got Lloyd's of London, right? When you talk about marine insurance, you can't have a conversation about marine insurance without talking about Lloyd's. And Lloyd's has stood the test of time. You know, it's had a number of shocks over the years, but Lloyd's has stood the test of time and is still, I would say, like the bedrock produced provider of marine insurance on the global market. And so, you know, the London market is still strong, you know, and then the domestic market here in the US, you know, a lot of what I do is, you know, I go through domestic carriers. And so we've certainly seen, like a lot of industries, there's been consolidation. And, you know, the insurance industry is no different. There's been quite a bit of consolidation. We've seen capacity reduced. So the number of insurance companies that are willing to write marine risks has decreased. Just, you know, in the 5 years that I've been doing this, I've already seen, you know, a contraction of the industry there. Having said that, I think, you know, we're still in what they call a hard market. But I think it's becoming hopefully less hard. And we are starting to see capacity that had left the market kind of coming back in. You know, they realized that the companies that stayed in the market were able to charge pretty nice premiums. And so they're realizing that, well, you know, maybe we need to get back into the marketplace. So, you know, we're still in a hard market and, you know, the cost of claims continues to be high in the United States. I mean, we live in a very litigious society. And so the cost of adjudicating claims is high. I mean, there's lawsuits constantly being bandied about. And so, you know, it's still a tough market, but the insurance market, I mean, it continues to charge ahead.
Has climate change impacted the risk in maritime operations in terms of insurance?
Well, certainly, I think that the insurance industry has become much more aware of climate change, you know, in the past few decades. I mean, as you think about, you know, the increasing frequency and intensity of storms and the impacts to coastal infrastructure, right? So, you know, you think about, you know, your shipyards or your, you know, I think as the climate has changed and like you say, the intensity and the frequency of these events has increased and the payouts the insurance companies have provided, I mean, I think they're much more aware of the impacts of climate change than they have been in the past. But I think that's a broader trend you see in the business community as a whole. I mean, I think the business community sees climate impacts and they want to plan for the future. And so how do we build our business models? You can't build a business model based on the assumption that the environment is going to remain static. And so how do you factor in climate change and how do you plan for the future? So the insurance industry is certainly doing that. You know, I think one of the things we've seen recently, I mean, I hate to keep coming back to fisheries, but, you know, the crab fisheries in the Bering Sea and the U.S. side were closed this year. There are a lot of reasons why the abundance of crab is down, but climate seems to be a big driver on that. And so, you know, you think about these crab vessels and the insurance companies are insuring these vessels, the ability of the fishermen to pay their premium is dependent on them having fisheries, right? So if your fisheries are closed, you're not going to be able to generate the revenue to pay your insurance premium. And so, I mean, that has certainly caught the insurance companies, got their attention.
Interesting. And then, Mark, what about sort of looking ahead? There's new propulsion techniques coming out. We just spoke with somebody yesterday. They're making electric tugs now, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like fiberglass on its own was like a step up from wood. I bet they're now they're making carbon fiber boats for all I know. How are those dynamics changing in the insurance world?
Well, if it's okay, I'm going to make a plug for another panel that I'm helping to put together. Sure. So I'm involved with a group in Seattle called the Marine Insurance Association of Seattle. And we have an annual day of education event that we're going to be putting on this coming fall. And so myself and a colleague of mine within the organization, we're putting together a panel on alternative fuels. And so we have three panelists coming to speak, one of whom is an engineer, and they do a lot of shoreside infrastructure that would be supporting electrification in large part. We have another individual who works for a naval architecture firm, and they've done a lot of work, obviously, on electrification, but also looking at things like, you know, methane and different types of alternative fuels. And then our third panelist comes from more kind of the, you know, he's a commissioner on one of the ports. And so really, what can the ports do to foster, you know, alternative fuel development, to provide the shore-based infrastructure, to incentivize operators to look at alternative propulsion systems. So really, you know, what can you do from the public policy perspective to encourage these alternative fuel developments? And then, like I say, we have two people, you know, on the, that are kind of at the cutting edge on the engineering and design side. But from a risk management perspective, I mean, the reason that we're putting this panel together, you know, this Marine Insurance Association of Seattle is insurance industry professionals. And so, you know, look, when you have a diesel engine, I mean, the risks are pretty well known. We've been operating diesel engines for, you know, 100 years. We know what the risks are. But when you have these alternative fuels and these developing technologies, that risk, I mean, it's very new. And so the reason that we have this panel is to help our underwriting friends better understand what does this changing technology look like from a risk management perspective. And, you know, if you are underwriting a risk and putting up your company's money, better know what you're talking about. And so, I mean, it's exciting. You know, it's the movement towards alternative fuels. It's a huge new opportunity for the industry. And I think it's also a huge new opportunity for the insurance industry. If you can get your head around those risks and underwrite them profitably, I think it's a great opportunity for the industry.
So insurance and law are both confusing. In your experience of dealing with maritime insurance, what is the biggest misconception you've run into?
You know, I'll go back to my comment about the cocktail party. I think a lot of people think it's boring. Look, I can't speak to, you know, home life and auto, but marine insurance is exciting. You know, it's hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years of history. There's a, you know, a very rich narrative around that, whether it be Lloyd's of London, or I just recently read a book and it really talked about the role that the insurance industry played in kind of the development of the United States during the Revolutionary War and even before. So, you know, there are a lot of things that we, you know, we still have forms that make reference to things that haven't happened. I mean, barratry and piracy and letters of marque and countermarque. I mean, things that, you know, people don't even know what they are now. But, you know, it's an industry rich in history. But it's also, like I say, it's, in my opinion, one of the underpinnings of global commerce. And so, you know, it's everywhere around you. And with things like alternative fuels, or, you know, we see more technology being working its way into the industry, into the insurance world. It's dynamic. It's ever changing. It's really exciting, in my opinion. And so the popular misconception people think about just insurance is boring, I would counter that all day long.
What is the biggest challenges that marine insurance companies face?
Oh, man, that's a good question. You know, I think maintaining the viability of the industry. I mean, without a marine industry, there's no marine insurance industry. And so I'm going to shift focus a little bit. We see, you know, there's a global shortage of mariners. And there's also, you know, there aren't people clamoring to go to work in shipyards. I mean, young people, you know, how do you attract young people to the industry? And so I'm involved in some efforts in Seattle and Puget Sound to kind of make sure that you have that next generation of maritime workers coming into the industry. And so that's a challenge for the industry as a whole. I think it's also a challenge in the marine insurance industry. You know, I can use my own experience as well. I mean, I mentioned to you earlier that, you know, I didn't come from the insurance industry. I was essentially recruited by existing insurance industry professionals. And one of the things that factored into my decision-making was I looked around me at all the brokers in Seattle, and many of them were well north of 60 and some even north of 70 years old. And so, you know, looking at the demographics, there weren't a lot of, you know, young insurance industry professionals coming up. And I saw an opportunity for myself where it's like, okay, you know, there's all these brokers that are going to be retiring in the next 10 to 15 years. And there's not a young cohort coming into the industry. And here I am, I've got, you know, 20 years in the maritime world, and I've got 20 years left in my working life. And, you know, here's an opportunity for me. And so I think making sure that you've got the next generation of people coming into the marine insurance industry and the maritime industry as a whole, I think that's a challenge. Obviously, climate change, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty there in terms of, you know, what does the world look like? You know, we can't underwrite based on, you know, the world as it looked 20, 30, 40 years ago. We need to be thinking about what does it look like in the future.
Well, firstly, I totally agree with you, right? And as you had mentioned previously, it was basically communication issues between, you know, the fishermen and policymakers and scientists. But even within the marine industry, there's this disconnect where, frankly, the industry kind of needs to work together in order to promote itself, to bring in the youth. And likely, you know, through all of your experiences, I'm sure that you were the youngest person doing at every step. You're probably one of the youngest people. So how do we create collaboration and communication throughout Marine?
Well, you know, I mentioned the Washington Maritime Federation earlier, and you know, that was the idea behind the Federation in large part, was that, you know, there are certainly issues that, you know, that divide the various sectors, but there are issues that we have in common. There are things that we can work on, you know, for the betterment of the industry as a whole. And so certainly forums like the Maritime Federation, where you have collaboration amongst the industry, I mean, those are important. You know, I think on the issue of workforce development, certainly if you go to most shipyards in the Puget Sound area and you look at, you know, the average age of shipyard workers, or you go on tugboat, you see that they talk about the graying of the fleet or the silver tsunami. You know, and we know that's coming. We're seeing it today. And so I think that's another thing that the industry, I mean, it's been somewhat slow to react, but I think, you know, we have programs, we have what's called the Core Plus Maritime Curriculum that's in, you know, in high schools in Washington State. And so in terms of education, for many years, I mean, we had, you know, the education community in, you know, in high schools and things like that. I mean, guidance counselors, I mean, they were driving kids towards college, right? It's 4-year college. That's the only thing. So we saw a lot of, you know, what they call shop classes and, you know, kind of that traditional vocational education. We saw that kind of put by the wayside. And so programs like Core Plus are really, you know, working with the industry to bring that vocational education back into the classrooms at the high school level to prepare you for jobs right out of high school. I mean, you can go right to work in a shipyard or a boatyard, or, you know, you can pursue additional educational opportunities. We have another group in the Puget Sound area, the Maritime High School, and that's a high school focused on bringing youth into the maritime industry. I know there are another similar organizations around the country. I mean, I believe there's a New York Harbor School. I'm probably butchering the name there, but same idea, you know, how do we reach high school kids and bring them into the industry? And so, you know, I think that's something that the industry really needs to work on is, how do we make sure that we've got the next generation of mariners and maritime industry professionals?
Hmm. So you sound pretty passionate about insurance. And I know you took the long way sort of to get there, but what advice would you give to perhaps some of our listeners, perhaps younger listeners, who want to get into insurance or even the actuarial sciences? What should they be looking for? How should they do this?
You know, insurance touches so many different things. So if you're on the tech side, right, so many people want to be involved in technology. And, you know, not everyone's going to work at Google or Amazon or Facebook. But, you know, there's a lot of opportunities on the tech side in the insurance world. Absolutely. So, I mean, if that's something you're interested in, and, you know, you mentioned the actuarial sciences. I'm terrible at math. I'll be the first to admit that. But, you know, if you have that quantitative ability, you know, the modeling that goes into a lot of these underwriting decisions. I mean, if you're a modeler and you have that, you know, those quantitative skills, there's a lot of opportunity in the insurance side as well. But I think the biggest thing is, if that's something that you think you might be interested in, I mean, reach out. Most people, I mean, at least in the marine insurance side of the world, I can only speak to that. But most of the people that I come across, you know, my colleagues, they're passionate about what they do. They've had rich and rewarding careers, and they're willing to share. So, you know, reach out.
And as we wrap this up, can you tell our listeners where to find you and, you know, read more about what you guys are working on?
Well, sure. So I work for Parker Smith & Feek. The company is based in Bellevue, Washington. I'm in Seattle, just across the lake. Certainly go to our website. You can get my contact information there. Look me up on LinkedIn. I'm happy to chat with anyone. I am passionate about the maritime industry. I am passionate about marine insurance. I want to share that. So feel free, like I say, find my contact information on our website. Reach out to me on LinkedIn. Those are two great opportunities or two great avenues.
I hope you still get to go on the ocean, though. You're not just office bound.
No, I do. I make it a point. You know, I really want to understand my clients. You know, I want to understand their operations. So I take every opportunity I can to get out on the boats, to get into the yards. I'm more comfortable in rain gear and boots than I am in a suit and tie. I'll put on a suit and tie when the time is right, but I'm happy to you know, jump on the boat. I'm actually going to go out this coming Friday. I'm going out on a, I don't remember what year the boat was built. I want to say 1924, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's, you know, wow. It's a historic wood vessel. It's a boat called the Vita Mia. It's here in Hawaii in the Alakai, or pardon me, the Alawai Harbor. And so I'm going to go out with my son and my brother-in-law on this boat. We're going to do a coffee cruise out to Diamond Head. So I get to do that. You know, I'll still jump on, you know, I've got a good friend who's got a small commercial fishing operation up in the northern Puget Sound. So I'll still jump on the boat with them every now and again. Not quite as strong or as resilient as I was maybe 20 years ago, but I could still pick some fish out of the net. So yeah, I don't waste any opportunity to get out.
Awesome. Nice. Well, Mark, it was great talking to you. And yeah, I mean, continue on the battle.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you guys having me on today. And I appreciate the work you're doing with the podcast. And, you know, you keep up the battle too. So thank you.
Thanks, man. Great chat. Have a good one.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode. And be sure to like, share, and subscribe to ShipShape.pro.